Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
My name is Annette, and I am a medical student here in the college, and it is my delight to welcome you all to this evening's talk. We are delighted on behalf of the Thomistic Institute that each one of you have come here today. A little word on what the Thomistic Institute is. It's an international organisation that supports lectures on Catholic theology and intellectual tradition at over 90 universities throughout the world. And tonight is a collaboration with the Catholic Society and with the Medical Ethics Society also. So thank you so much for all your help. And a special thank you to Father Ben Hughes for being so kind to allow us the chaplaincy for refreshments afterwards. You will see a sign-up sheet that is making its way around. And you can pop your name and your email down there, and we will let you know of future Thomistic Institute events. And for tonight's schedule, so following the talk, there will be a time for questions and answers. And then everybody is warmly invited to the chaplaincy for pizza afterwards. And on to tonight's speaker. So I'm delighted to welcome Professor Lydia Dugdale all the way from New York to go away here tonight. Professor Dugdale is a physician, a clinical ethicist, a professor of medicine at the Columbia University Medical Center, a wife to Kyle and a mother to Ella and Zena. She trained at the University of Chicago and joined Yale School of Medicine, where she taught for 10 years before moving to New York in 2020. And I actually have a copy of the book that she published here that was brought by a fan looking for it to be signed on the lost art of dying. And isn't it beautiful? As well as that, she has written on the medical. She has written many medical ethics articles for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. She has spoken in many prestigious settings, and we are so grateful that she has travelled across the Atlantic to be with us here tonight. So please give her a warm Galway welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I speak with an American accent, so I hope that this all goes well. It's really delightful to be here with you. I was able to bring my children and my husband over since it's midwinter break, and so we've had a really delightful day at the cliffs today, which are just stunning, and the Aran Islands yesterday. So thank you so much for the welcome, to Annette for hosting, and also to Father Connor. I'm going to jump right in. I can easily spend far too long giving any version of this talk, and I'd like to leave time for questions and answers. So we're going to jump in. Here's what I'd like to cover today. First of all, I'd like to talk just a little bit about medicalized dying. I don't know if it's as much of a problem here in Ireland as it is in the United States, but we'll get into that just a little bit. Then I'm going to talk to you about the Ars Moriendi, which, as you know, is Latin for the art of dying. This is an older model on the preparation for death, which was very, very popular for more than 500 years in the West. So we'll consider that for a bit before discussing what the revival of an Ars Moriendi might look like today. So this is just to get us off, some Irish data here. Less than 1% of Irish people die each year. In fact, for men, it's slightly higher than women. You can see their total deaths in 2023. It was about 6.7 people per 1,000, so about 0.67%. Now, what does that mean? There would be one way to read this, that death is not very much of a problem. Therefore, we don't need to be having this lecture tonight, and we could all get on with the reception. That's one way to think about it. But here's another way to think about death. And this, you might say, this is, you know, rather old data. It ends in 2023. But I can guarantee that the data have not changed. Even for 2025, the lifetime risk of death remains 100%. And so therefore, my contention is that we really do need guidance on end-of-life preparation. All of us do, because all of us will certainly die at some point. So let's start with an image here. I think you can make out the gist of it from the back of the room, but I will zoom in for you. Does anyone know who painted this? No takers, huh? No art historians in the computer science building? Okay, this is Hieronymus Bosch. So we're just zooming in here to the bottom. Now, if you take in the whole of the painting, you have the dying man in his bed. He's being attended to by an angel. There's another gentleman in the foreground, and that's where we're going to zoom in. Now, Hieronymus Bosch painted this, Death and the Miser is the title, and it was part of a genre of paintings where people would be challenged to think about how they were living and how their living might translate into how they would die. And so this is a miser on his deathbed. Now, art historians think that this gentleman in the foreground with the yellow greenish robe is the miser when he was a younger, healthier man. Why do we think he's the miser? Well, here he is, either putting coins in or taking coins out of this chest. There's a sack of coins in a chest that is under lock and key. And we know that it's under lock and key because the key is tied around his waist. So we think this is probably the miser when he was a younger man. Now, Bosch would want you to know that this is not morally neutral. It is not just that this is a gentleman who likes his personal wealth, but actually Bosch would want you to know there's a battle for this man's soul. Why do we think that? Well, as is classically understood, let me see if my pointer works. You see, these are demons here that are meant to represent sort of the evil forces. So there is a battle for this man's soul. If we can keep him clinging to his material possessions all the way until he dies, he will not only live poorly, but he will die poorly. So there's an association in art and literature for much of late medieval period, all the way until quite recently, that one's living is very much tied to one's dying. If one wants to die well, one must live well. So let's just go to the top of the painting now. Here we see the same gentleman, okay? This is our miser. He's now much paler and much frailer. The medical students in the room might say he looks cachectic. Do you use that word here in Ireland? He's wasting away. The angel is desperately trying to direct his gaze up to the crucifix in the window, but of course the miser will have none of it. You see, Bosch painted death itself coming in at the door, and very cleverly, death is aiming an arrow at the miser's heart, and he even extended the shadow of the arrow. You see that there? The shadow of the arrow is extended to this man's heart. There can be no question about it. This man is dying. Okay? Now, where is the miser's right hand extended even in his moment of dying? Still, he can't help himself. He's taken, and yet there's another demon, right? Seeking to entice him to cling to his material possessions as matter of highest importance, even in his moment of death. So I contrast this image from Hieronymus Bosch from the late 1400s with an image that I had commissioned for this book that Annette mentioned. And this might be a different way of thinking about dying, more of a modern way of dying, a medicalized way of dying. You see a gentleman alone in his hospital bed. There are no angels. There are no demons. There's no crucifix. I've always practiced medicine in very large, urban, non-religiously affiliated institutions. So this is pretty much what it looks like. He doesn't have much community. That's a big problem we have in New York City where I practice. And he's hooked up to a machine. This is fairly typical for modern dying. So let's talk for a minute about medicalized dying. And I will tell you that it is the fixation on medicalized dying that set me on this trajectory to try to think about a better way to anticipate our mortality and prepare for death. So here's a case that I had about 20 years ago when I was the young doctor assigned to the code team. Do you call them codes when somebody's heart stops, cardiac arrest? And all right, and I'm looking for you for my Irish translation. So I was working in the hospital on an overnight, and the announcement goes off overhead, and our pagers started beeping. And there was an alert that a gentleman had died in the cancer ward. And so we all went running, those of us assigned to the resuscitation team, we went running to the cancer ward. And lo and behold, there's this elderly gentleman, absolutely emaciated, absolutely wasting away. And the doctor who was overnight in the cancer ward is reading from some notes, didn't really know the patient, and said, you know, 88-year-old gentleman, he had had prostate cancer about 20 years ago, adequately treated. It went into remission for many, many years, but recently he developed new confusion and bony pain. So his adult daughters brought him into the hospital. They scanned him head to toe, which is our tradition in America for patients with remote cancer. And they found, lo and behold, there are metastases. There's cancer. The cancer had come back after 20 years of remission. It's in his brain, hence the confusion. It was all through his ribs. Why do I note the ribs? Because when we resuscitate, we compress the ribs. And it was throughout many of his bones. So very painful. Cancer in the bones is very painful. The daughters, of course, wanted us to attempt resuscitation. Now, when doctors look at a gentleman this age with this sort of medical history, we're a bit loath to resuscitate. But in America, in many locations, if this is what the family insists upon, despite the age, despite the medical history, we are required, in fact, to attempt resuscitation. So we were able to bring his heart back, which means we restored him to life, which was quite extraordinary. But we knew, we were quite certain that he would probably die again that same night. And in fact, he did. Within about 90 to 120 minutes, the overhead announcement went off and he had died a second time. I knew, because I had debriefed with the daughters after the first resuscitation, that they wanted us to keep doing everything possible, which is the language that we commonly use on the other side of the pond. We resuscitated him again, knowing full well he would die again. And in fact, he died a third time that night, at which point we did attempt resuscitation per the daughter's requests, but ultimately we were unable to bring his pulse back and we declared him officially dead. This case weighed on me. This happened when, 20 years ago when I was quite young in the profession, and it weighed on me that this is the way that we would approach patients who were not only advanced in age, but advanced in illness, that this was an acceptable form of dying. And this is, as I said, what set me off on thinking about alternative ways that communities have thought about anticipating death and preparing. If you ask most people, at least in America, they say they want to die at home surrounded by loved ones. My sense is that there's probably a similar number here in Ireland, that most people would prefer not to be institutionalized and to be surrounded by those they love at the end. This is true, sort of generally speaking. It's true of patients with advanced cancer. And yet in America, about 60% die in institutions. I looked at the numbers for Ireland, and it's very similar. So about 41% of Irish people die in hospitals, and 17% die in nursing homes. So gets us almost to a similar number. More than half, almost 60%, are dying in institutions. This was from the New England Journal. This got a lot of press when it first came out. Again, this is American side, but it got a lot of press because for the first time in 2017, home deaths surpassed hospital deaths, that slight bump up in the orange line over the blue line. However, when you take hospital deaths combined with nursing facility deaths combined with hospice facility deaths, that gives us that number of about 60%. So still, Americans are generally not dying where they want to. And my sense from the numbers is that that's similar here in Ireland. Something else we're very good at is over-treatment. Over-treatment at the end of life is widespread, and sometimes, in fact, less is more. Some of you, the medical people in the room, will be familiar with this study. Just a little shout out. You might know that the New England Journal is kind of considered our top medical journal in America, affiliated with Harvard University. This study got a lot of press because it was a study that compared patients with new diagnoses of non-small cell lung cancer. So new lung cancer, one group got conventional treatment and the other group got conventional treatment plus early access to palliative care. What does palliative care do? Focuses on whole person care, community, relief of symptoms, family, spiritual support. So it's sort of conventional treatment plus. And what they found out with this study is that for people who were randomized into the conventional treatment plus, they were less likely to pursue chemotherapy. They reported feeling much better. They didn't have as much depression. And in fact, they lived about 2.5 months longer than the people who got the chemotherapy and felt terrible. And so this was a wake-up call to the profession of medicine to rethink how aggressive we might be for people with advanced illness. Now, I contrast that story I gave you of the gentleman I resuscitated 3 times in one night with this case from Florence, Italy, from the mid-1300s. Now, has anybody in the room read Giovanni Boccaccio's The Decameron? All right, couple, great. So Giovanni Boccaccio was an Italian humanist, something of a philosopher, an intellectual. Basically, he was somebody who was so wealthy he didn't have to actually work for a living. And he was able to write and read and kind of pass his time in sort of intellectual leisure. Now, in the mid-1300s, the bubonic plague sweeps Western Europe. And Boccaccio, who had been living in Florence, did what wealthy Florentines did. He got out of town and went to his countryside villa. The medical students will know that plague is transmitted by a combination of rats and fleas. And so if you could get to a countryside villa where there were no rats, you would be safe from plague. And so, in fact, that's what Boccaccio does. So Boccaccio takes some of his friends with him, and they pass the time in quarantine by telling each other stories, which is what he assembles into the book, The Decameron. The Decameron is just a series of 10 stories that friends tell themselves. It's all fiction. Friends tell themselves while they're in quarantine to pass the time. What's fascinating about this book is the introduction to The Decameron is not fiction. It is Boccaccio's description of what it was like to be in Florence when the plague hit before he left town. And he describes all kinds of things. He describes people transporting bodies to what he calls the first tombs they found untenanted. He describes pigs devouring or chewing on the clothing of someone who had died of plague, and then the pigs themselves succumbing to plague. He describes what it looked like to have the bubonic form of plague. Bubo is from the Greek meaning groin, because there would be characteristic swellings of the lymph nodes that run along the legs that they would refer to as bubos. So that was why it's called bubonic. He says there appeared certain swellings either on the groin or under the armpits the size of an apple or an egg. So that's the bubonic. And then he says, sometimes the contagion began to change into black or livid blotches, and that's referring to the gangrenous form of the gangrene form of bubonic plague, which is what gave it the name Black Death. And I think I have a picture I'll show you, but let's talk about this for a second. This is an etching by the Italian artist Luigi Sabatelli. We think it comes from the early 1800s. For those of you who read Italian, you can see down here, it says, "The Plague of Florence as described by Boccaccio." So this is an image of the Sabatelli reading the Boccaccio, reading that introduction to the Decameron, reading the introduction to the Decameron, and then trying to make an image of what he thought Florence might be like during the plague. And so here we are, we're outside the city walls, there are the walls, and you see this mass of bodies in the foreground, slightly to the right. These are bodies that have not, there's been no anointing of the sick, there's been no proper burial. These are bodies that are just discarded here. And then here is this group of men that Boccaccio describes from his language, from the baser ranks of society, who would hire themselves out to deposit these bodies in the first tombs they found untenanted. Now, those of you who know anything about the way that diseases spread would be concerned about these gentlemen risking their lives to make money to bury the dead. But that's what they did, and they didn't obviously understand germ theory or bacteria or know about how it was spread. But it was worth it to try to make some dollars, make some euros by burying the dead. Here in the background, we think this is a priest who's giving a general benediction on the dead. But of course, this would not have been the proper way to bury all of these people. And then we have here a gentleman bringing out more bodies. This looks like a stretcher, but it's most likely a funeral bier, just dumping more bodies into this pile. And then here, Sabatelli put into the etching an image of Boccaccio himself. Some art historians have posited that perhaps he's holding a copy of Dante's Inferno. Others think that perhaps he's holding a copy of the Decameron. And then here, just, you know, you can see Boccaccio. He fancied the laurel leaves there. So here we have, this is Boccaccio. What we think with this particular outbreak of plague is that perhaps as many as 2/3 of the population succumbed. Why do we think that? Well, if you look at church records, you get a sense of what happened to a population in a given area. But also, lesser outbreaks of plague have been known to take as many as 50% of the living. And even lesser outbreaks, 30 to 40%. So we could safely say that somewhere between 1/3 and 2/3 of the population of Europe died from this particular outbreak of plague. Now, does anyone know what the mortality rate was during COVID? It was also less than 1%. Some places about 0.5% just from COVID itself. Now, you think about having 30 to 66% of the population die from a particular outbreak of plague in a couple of years' time. We can't even imagine what that would do to a community, right? You're going to have children who are orphaned. You are going to have grandparents with no family left to look after them. You're going to have wealthy people with no servants and servants with no one to serve. It's going to completely upset an entire generation of people. And that's exactly what happened. Now here, this is just for our medical people in the room, right? So these are these characteristic lymph node swellings. Greek for groin is bubo. So that's hence the term bubonic plague. And then here is that we would call it acral gangrene. So it's a gangrene of the tips of the fingers, the toes, the nose, and the lips that was very characteristic of Black Death. Again, it's the same disease, different manifestations. Those tips of the fingers would actually, that tissue would die and it would auto-amputate and fall off. Now, you might look at these photographs and say, wow, those photographs don't look like they're from the mid-14th century. And you would be absolutely correct. Does anyone know where we see bubonic plague or Black Death pop up every so often? Iran? Very, very likely. I think most commonly of sub-Saharan Africa. That's where I've seen the most reports, but I'm sure you're right. Why doesn't this destroy entire communities like it used to?
Because of the burial rituals?
No, actually because of something much more modern, which is antibiotics. So I don't know if you have it here, azithromycin?
Yeah.
So in America, we have a 5-day course of azithromycin that gets rid of all kinds of illnesses, including bubonic plague. It's extraordinary to think about 2/3 of the population dying from a disease that we can easily treat with 5 days of antibiotics now. For those of us, which is most of us, all of us, who were came of age in the antibiotic era, we don't even know what it's like to see that extreme loss of life from not having access to basic antibiotics. This is just for fun. This is the plague doctor. This is the characteristic attire. Now, you might think the plague doctor looks like a bird, and that would, in fact, be true. There's a twofold function for that beak. The first is that the doctor would stuff the beak with herbs and spices to mask the stench of the decaying flesh. Not only did the flesh smell bad, this is also a pre-hygienic era, right? No indoor plumbing, so it would sort of be foul smelling all around. So it would have that very practical function. But there was a second reason for the beak, and that was to invoke an Egyptian divinity. The idea was that if you don't know why everyone is dying, getting sick and dying, you might as well pull out all the stops, right? And so you might as well dress up like a bird because maybe that will help. And that was exactly the thinking. The doctor would dress in a long waxed raincoat, would wear trousers underneath, gloves. They even had glass eye sockets here to protect the eyes. It's very interesting that they would cover every parts of their body, not knowing how the disease was spread. And this is exactly what we did in the early days of COVID. So my family moved to New York City just 6 months before COVID hit New York. And COVID was not kind to New York City at all. And I became a frontline COVID doctor working in an extension of our emergency department in a tent on Broadway. And so that's where I spent my first weeks of COVID. But I remember those early days, we literally covered every bit of ourselves and just recycled our PPE, our personal protective equipment, every day because, well, for one, we didn't have enough of this gear to cover up. But two, we didn't know how COVID exactly was being spread. And so we covered every bit of our bodies just like the plague doctor did. Okay, so why do I tell you about the 14th century? And why do I contrast that with this example of the patient that I attempted resuscitation on three times? The reason I did it is because it was coming out of the bubonic plague. Now, you remember, again, two-thirds of the population, as many as two-thirds of the population succumbed. Many people were not buried properly. There were not funeral masses. There was not care of the dying, attention to the questions of the dying person, no catechism at the end. And so there was a real concern that these people had died and not been cared for well spiritually. There was concern for where they might go, where they might be in the afterlife. And those who survived the plague began to really sort of call for help in preparing for death. Because the survivors knew that plague could come back. And if it wasn't plague, it might be famine. And if it wasn't famine, it might be war. But something was going to kill people. Mortality then as now was 100%. And so the survivors wanted help preparing for death. The leading social authority at the time was the Western Church, right? Western Europe, it's the Western Church. And so there was a real cry on the part of the laity to the clergy for help in preparing for death. Now, for those of you who know your church history, you'll know the late 1300s was not the church's best time. There were two men simultaneously claiming to be pope, and then later a third man claiming to be pope. And so there's a real leadership crisis in the church and an inability for the church to respond to the cries of the laity. And it was only in the early 1400s when the church resolves this problem of the plural popes that we begin to see circulating handbooks on how to prepare for death. And there's more to say about this. I can go into more detail. But we think that one of the members of the Council of Constance, the Council of Constance is where the church resolved this pope problem. One of the members of the Council of Constance had come with a bit of a handbook on how to prepare for death. And that, we think, was probably the seed manuscript for the broader manuscript, which is anonymous, that began circulating, we think, by 1415 is the oldest version of which we're aware. And so this then leads us to the Ars Moriendi. Again, Ars Moriendi is Latin for the art of dying. You'll see here this says 1450, 1450, and you might say she just said 1415, 1415, and that's true, I did. So the oldest version that we know of, the oldest art of dying handbook, comes from 1415, but 1450 is about the date, we think, for the first illustrated version. And I'm going to talk to you about those illustrations in a second. Why an illustrated version? Any guesses on why we would need an illustrated version in 1450? Oh, wow. That's about right. Yes. High illiteracy rate. When I was in medical school, this is just a trick for the medical students. They taught us that if your attending physician asks you a question and you think the number is big, guess 85%. And if you think the number is small, guess 15%. And you're likely to be close. And so I Googled this. Who knows if Google is correct on this, but they do think that maybe only about 15% of the population was literate. So small number, we're going to guess 15. Okay, so Ars Moriendi is a genre of literature. The very first handbook comes out of the church, anonymous author, anonymous illustrator for the first 1450 illustrated version. But this goes on to be a wildly popular genre of literature all throughout the West. It is translated into many languages. When the Protestants show up on the scene, they're developed Protestant versions. By at least the 1800s, there are Jewish versions, and then there are completely secular, non-religious versions of the Art of Dying, of the Ars Moriendi, that are unique for each group that develops them. If you look at, I haven't read every single one, actually, Father Connor, wherever he went, Father Connor told me about an Irish one, too, that I'm going to show you on a slide in just a second. But so I have not read them all. I've read many. But I would say if you were to take all of them, religious and non-religious, over a 500-year period, there are two things that are absolutely central, although there are more things that are in general. The two things that are absolutely central is that all of the texts require an acknowledgement of human finitude. You've got to say that you're mortal. If you're not even willing to think about your mortality, it's hard to do the work of preparing for death. So that's quite foundational. And then the second, which is perhaps rather antithetical to our current moment, is the role of community. And I don't know about Ireland, but in the United States, we're actually facing a loneliness crisis, where depending on the study, between 25 and 50% of Americans report being lonely or very lonely. And so the idea that community, that we are relational creatures who live and flourish best in relationship with others. Not only do we live best in relationship, we die best in relationship. That's fundamental to all of these versions of the Ars Moriendi. Classically, though, they would give advice on how to anticipate death and prepare. So again, many different versions, but often there would be a question and answer where the community could ask the dying person what they believe, could help them reaffirm their beliefs, say prayers. There were prayers both for the dying person to say and for the community to pray on behalf of the dying when the dying person was no longer able to pray. There were practices, advice. Some of them got very practical, how to care for the dying. So lots of different versions. This is the one from that Father Connor gave me. And so it dates, it's actually a very early manuscript, dates to 1437 to 1440. And this is a manuscript that has a lot of different components to it, but many of the components do relate to the art of dying specifically. And he told me that there is this line, death is the end of every life. This is written in Irish, which I could not read. So if you go to the very first version, and this carried through many of the early versions of the Ars Moriendi, there was this idea that if you wanted to die well, you had to live well. And so just as I showed you that painting by Hieronymus Bosch, Death and the Miser, one of the ways in the late Middle Ages that they believed that you would die poorly is if you died in a state of greed, sort of clinging to your material possessions, right? And so if you don't want to be known as a greedy person when you die, then you need to practice generosity. But you don't just live a greedy life and practice generosity at the end. No, in fact, you cultivate the virtue, make generosity a habit throughout your life, then you live better and you die better. And so these were the big five in the earliest versions. They widely felt that it was bad to die in a state of doubt, despair, impatience, pride, or greed. That was dying poorly. Those were repeated in many different versions of the early versions of the Ars Moriendi. And then if you don't want to die that way, then you practice these other ways of being, what you might call virtues or habits of faith, hope, patience, humility, and generosity. That's what it meant to die well, but it also was what it meant to live well. So this is just to give you a little sense of what the Ars Moriendi were like. This is the oldest illustrated version. Just the oldest illustrated version from 1450 had 11 images. So these are two of those 11. The 11 images are the five temptations to dying poorly, juxtaposed with the five commendations to living well. And then there's a final image of the dying person on his deathbed. But just to give you just a very quick sense, I'm going on too long. So here we have the dying man in bed. He's kicking away the doctor. That's the doctor there. He's knocked over the table. All these things are littering the floor. This, we think, is his wife. And this is a scroll. It says in Latin, this is as when you read a comic strip and they have that sort of bubble coming out, what the person's saying, that's what this is. And the wife is saying, see how he suffers. So a nice expression of compassion. Then the illustrator would want you to know this is not, again, morally neutral. There's a battle for his soul. This is not just an old guy who wants to die and get it over with. There's actually forces of evil at work here. And this demon says, look how I have deceived him. Don't want to die in a state of impatience. So we need to cultivate patience throughout life. Here's the same dying man. He's being attended to by an angel, by Christ, by God the Father. There's still some demons, but they're pretty disempowered. They don't look like they've got much edge up on anybody here. But interestingly, these four characters, if you learned your theology or your Bible through imagery, as was the case in the early 15th century, you would know who these characters are. Most of us probably don't, but these are all martyrs of the Christian faith. And by putting martyrs here, it was a way of saying there are others who have gone before you and struggled, and they also have wanted to give up, but they haven't. They've endured until the end, and they've died well. So this is Stephen, first century martyr, with the stones. He's holding the stones. He's holding the object of his martyrdom. Barbara, so legend has it that Barbara, her father locked her in a tower to hide her from the seductions of the world, as one does. And while she was in the tower, she started reading the Bible because she was so bored. And then she converts to Christianity. Then her father gets really angry because now he has a Christian convert. So he beheads her. So poor Barbara, that's the way she went. And then we have Catherine with her wheel on which she was tortured, and Lawrence with his gridiron. But these images would have told the viewer others have suffered too, but they have endured and they have died well. You too can endure until the end and die well. So that's this idea that dying well is very much wrapped up in living well. Now, I wanted to just mention this because, as I said, the genre did not stay within a particular Christian denomination, nor did it stay within Christendom, nor did it stay within religion. So Drew Faust, who's the former president of Harvard University, has this really beautiful book on death and the American Civil War. And she talks about how in America, by the time of the Civil War, our Civil War, which was 1860s, whether you were from the northern states or the southern states, whether you were rich or poor, whether you were religious or not, the idea that you would anticipate death and prepare for it was part of being brought up well. So you learned how to have polite conversation in society, you learned your table manners, and you learned to anticipate your mortality and to live a life that would reflect the way you wanted to be known when you died. That this idea that you would cultivate your character to be one that was regarded as having lived a good life mattered very much. So I told you this was a very, very popular genre of literature, more than 500 years all throughout the West. What happened to it? I had never heard of it. As a young medical trainee, I was very concerned about the way my patients were dying. and was looking for answers. How had people thought about mortality before? How had they prepared for death? And when I discovered the Ars Moriendi, I just a brief mention of it in a medical journal article I was reading, I thought, this is interesting because I practice in a large city with lots of different patients, lots of different backgrounds. How do we think about communicating the need for all people to anticipate their mortality and prepare well? What does that entail? Could we articulate something in a pluralistic context that would not be too lukewarm, that it would be meaningless, but that would also get people to do the work while they are able to prepare for death? So lots of reasons this fell out of favor. I'm just going to mention a couple, but maybe if we have time, we can talk about more if you're interested. The biggest reason that the Ars Moriendi fell out of favor as a genre happened about 100 years ago. World War I, 1914 to 1918, massive loss of life, not just soldiers. One of the striking features of World War I was civilian deaths. So lots and lots of people died. But even before the end of World War I, we have the outbreak of, Spanish flu, the influenza epidemic of 1918. And actually, we say the flu pandemic of 1918. It was actually 1918 to 1920. Epidemiologists think that there were four major waves, similar to COVID, actually, over a two-year period. So we have massive loss of life for 4 years from global war. Before that even ends, we have two more years of sustained massive loss of life from flu. So by the end of that, 6 years of sustained death globally, people did not want to think about dying anymore. They wanted to get on with living. And you see a real shift away from traditional mourning rituals. And used to be that doors, you'd hang a ribbon on the door to signify a child had died, one color, an adult had died, another color. Women would dress in mourning after the death of a spouse, etc. All of that went away. And you see a real shift toward a focus on living. 1920s is also when we discover antibiotics. By the 1940s, antibiotics are in widespread circulation. We also have the development of early chemotherapy. By the 50s and 60s, we are experimenting with organ transplantation, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and the mechanical ventilator. By the 60s and 70s, mechanical ventilators, those breathing machines, are everywhere, which now transforms even our conception of who is alive and who is dead, right? By the 70s, we have complex chemotherapy regimens and so forth. So really, in a post-World War II era, because World War II was really when antibiotics started circulating globally, death almost came to feel optional. You know, who dies? Who dies? Another striking change on the American side is that we went from about 300 hospitals in the 1870s to more than 6,000 in 50 years. So the just rapid expansion of the hospital, I wonder what it's like here, made it nobody needs to care for anybody at home anymore because you might as well take them to the hospital where maybe there's something that they could do. So all of this then led me to this project that I've sort of been on for 15 years now, asking first in a journal article and then in an academic book and then later in this book, could we revive the art of dying? And if I were to take this book and put it into three orange words, they would be health, home, and hope. But these are really the domains, I think, that we need to think about to do the work of anticipating death and preparing well. I'm going to skip through this so that we can have more time to talk. But let me just say very quickly, there are questions of thinking about how one might want to engage healthcare, doing risk assessments for frailty to help guide whether we would want to engage that additional surgery late in life, et cetera, thinking about what it takes to die, where one would like to die. So these very practical questions. I do think that's part of it. I was speaking recently in to a room full of kind of 50-year-old New Yorkers about some of this stuff, and it astounded me how little health literacy they had. Most of them still had reasonably healthy parents, and they hadn't had children die, and they just didn't know what happens in the hospital at the end of life. I think medical people certainly need to be doing this work for their communities, for our communities, to help educate our communities on what is the hospital like, and how do we think meaningfully about it so that we don't end up in these sort of medicalized dying processes. Questions of home, community, relationships, reconciliation is really important. I sometimes say to people, you know, it's important to think about who you would want at your deathbed. When you're at your deathbed, who do you want surrounding you? And then I ask, well, what is the state of those relationships now? I had a guy say to me once, he said, I know who I want to be there when I die, but frankly, I really don't like the guy right now. Do you think it's okay if I wait to sort of repair the relationship until I get the bad diagnosis? And of course, you know, he was making a joke, but the point is that if we do the work of reconciliation now, then not only will our living be better, but our dying will be better as well. So lots of things to do there. Ritual and practices, lots to say there. And then finally is this domain of hope. This gets to these existential questions, really. There's the practical, there's the human, but then there's the sort of metaphysical, the existential, the why am I here? What is life for? What happens when I die kind of questions. And my goal as a physician and caring for patients at the end of their lives is not to spoon feed them my answers to these questions. I want to get them thinking through these questions for themselves, wrestling with them in the context of their communities while they are able. I always tell my patients that I would like them to come to a place of peace on these questions. Partly I say that because I've also cared for patients who are just so enraged about these kinds of questions and haven't resolved them as they are dying. And that's it's really hard to be with a dying patient who is just really struggling. So working through this in the context of community while one is able is certainly what I recommend. So I'm going to stop there and just see if you all have any questions to round out our night together. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.